Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The White House has said it's going to pull some troops out of Iraq. Fewer soldiers, though, doesn't mean there's less work to be done. And the administration's plans for privatization took a big hit today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at vanguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's good to have you here today. Today is Monday, September the 17th. There are at least as many private contractors in Iraq as there are American soldiers, many of them at least as heavily armed as individual soldiers are. They're employed as private security guards, some of them, often for U.S. government officials. So perhaps what happened today was inevitable. The Iraqi government has revoked the business license of Blackwater USA, a private security firm based in North Carolina. Blackwater employees allegedly killed at least 9 Iraqi civilians yesterday, including a police officer in a firefight. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports Blackwater has played an important but often controversial role in the war.
Details of exactly what happened yesterday in a Sunni neighborhood in Baghdad are still emerging. U.S. officials say a State Department convoy with a Blackwater escort was attacked. Blackwater didn't return calls for comment today. But what's already clear is the fallout is going to be a major headache for both Blackwater and the U.S. State Department. Peter Singer follows private military contractors at the Brookings Institution.
We actually just had a $1 billion contract go to a consortium of companies led by Blackwater to do diplomatic security.
This is not the first time private military contractors have killed Iraqi civilians, but it is the first time the Iraqi government has publicly pushed back hard.
This is very important. The prime minister has described it as a crime. It's actually his quote, and that it's a crime that he wants the foreign contractors to be prosecuted for.
But the ability of the Iraqi government to prosecute any U.S. contractors in the country is severely limited. Doug Brooks runs a trade association that represents private military companies. He believes a law in the books dating from the early days of the U.S. occupation still grants foreign military contractors legal immunity in Iraq.
We don't know enough about the incident to know if a crime had been committed, but if there was, it can certainly be tried under U.S. laws.
But up until now, U.S. criminal prosecutions of contractors have been almost unheard of. Singer says a string of violent incidents has created a huge amount of resentment toward Western contractors in Iraq, and now the U.S. State Department is left with few appealing options for security. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The European Union's second highest court ruled today that the world's dominant software company is neither micro nor soft. Judges upheld the lower court's decision that the maker of the ubiquitous Windows software is using its size and market share to keep competitors out of the market. The ruling includes a fine of more than $600 million. That's not in and of itself a big deal for Microsoft. The company is sitting on tens of billions in cash. But court-ordered changes in the way Microsoft does business could be a problem, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
To comply, Microsoft will have to reveal closely guarded Windows secrets to enable rival software to work more smoothly with its near-monopoly operating system. It'll also have to continue selling a European version that doesn't contain Windows Media Player for video and audio. And Joe Wilcox, who writes for the blog Microsoft Watch, says today's decision opens up more potential challenges to Windows features, like built-in search engines.
So Google could come forward, complain about integrated search. Someone else could come and complain about web browsers. And Microsoft could in the future find itself unbundling a heck of a lot more than just a media player.
But Microsoft, which is still deciding whether to appeal, has already changed its go-it-alone business tactics. Computer analyst Rob Enderle says in anticipation of the European Union's hard line, Microsoft has been reaching out to former rivals.
So Novell and Sun, who are on the other side of this, are now relatively closely partnered with Microsoft. Sun is actually now selling Microsoft Windows on their hardware.
Given the global market for computer software, Microsoft may have a tough time meeting European competition laws that are very different from those in the U.S., where the company settled an antitrust case with the Justice Department back in 2001. The dual standard worries Sean Heather at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
This kind of difference of opinion between U.S. and EU regulators allows multiple other regulators around the globe to potentially craft their own view on what constitutes a competitive marketplace.
The Justice Department today said it's concerned the European ruling will stifle competition and innovation in the software industry. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It almost doesn't matter what happened on Wall Street today. Everybody's pretty much waiting to see what happens at tomorrow's Fed meeting, about which, more in a moment, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. In what might possibly be the worst-kept secret in the history of central banking, the Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates when it meets tomorrow. Could be a quarter of a percentage point, could be a half, we just don't know yet. But in the end, size may not matter. The American economy doesn't exactly turn on a dime, you know. And Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports the housing meltdown and the credit crunch might have too big a head start for a rate cut tomorrow to make much of a difference.
A cut in interest rates usually takes 9 months to a year to impact the economy, so don't expect financial relief overnight, especially for the hard-hit housing industry.
I'm afraid that the lift to the housing market will take a long time in coming, that lower interest rates aren't really going to help there, not quickly at least.
That's Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. He says the most immediate impact of a rate cut would be psychological.
It could have a beneficial effect if it buoys investor confidence. Investors are nervous, scared, they don't want to provide credit or liquidity. If they feel like the Federal Reserve is engaged and will do whatever it takes to keep the economy moving forward, then liquidity should improve.
Borrowers with adjustable rate mortgages could also benefit sooner rather than later. So says Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss.
We've got a lot of mortgages resetting in the fourth quarter. If the Fed lowers rates, those mortgages aren't going to set quite as high as they would have otherwise. That may give you a little more immediate impact, especially for the people whose mortgages are resetting.
For borrowers who are teetering on the brink of foreclosure, that minor rate adjustment could be enough to save the house. But Weiss says it won't be enough to save the housing economy. Going forward, he says that even as pressure on lenders begins to subside, the fallout from the housing mess will drag on into 2008. As a result, Weiss and other economists anticipate a series of rate cuts stretching into the months ahead. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A few words now about the man who used to run the Federal Reserve. Alan Greenspan's memoirs were released today. He's been making the rounds to plug the book, all 544 pages of it. You can flip through it all you want, but you won't find the answer to the economic question of the day anywhere in there. Are we headed for a recession? Matt Lauer asked him that on the Today Show this morning.
The evidence so far is not yet. The economy at this stage, despite this fiscal problem, despite the financial problem, is still holding up.
As so often happens with Mr. Greenspan, though, you have to check and double check to make sure you understood what he said. In a print interview with Reuters that hit the wires this morning, he said a recession's more likely now than it was just a couple of months ago. Back then, he guessed the odds were about 30%. And lest you think he's just a sour old economist with no sense of humor, he made a little inside joke last night on 60 Minutes when Leslie Stahl asked him why the economy's slowing down.
It's a freezing up that occurs basically because, if you'll excuse the expression, there's a long period of irrational exuberance going on.
I don't know if you could hear it, but he was smiling just a little bit when he said that.
Thank you.
It's easy these days to fill up on junk food, so you're trying to eat healthy. You run to the supermarket and grab some lettuce or maybe some spinach. Not the kind you actually have to clean yourself, but the pre-washed stuff in those plastic bags. There's a good chance that what you bought came from California's Salinas Valley, south of San Francisco. In the year since the E. coli outbreak that was traced to Salinas Valley spinach last fall, California's salad industry has lost tens of millions of dollars. Farmers and processors have come up with new ways to protect the food supply, but John Ryan reports some say those protections have gone too far.
Inside the largest factory of America's largest salad company, they don't make salad the way you'd make it at home. At the Fresh Express plant in Salinas, 5-foot-wide conveyor belts run spinach leaves through tanks of chlorinated water. Laser beams detect anything without chlorophyll, and micro-air jets puff the sticks or stones away without disturbing the green leaves all around them. The high-tech, low-temperature facility handles 1 million pounds of lettuce every day. Vice President for Manufacturing Bill Clyburn gets a group of visitors ready to go in.
First thing we have to do is there's no jewelry in the plant, so all your watches have to come off. Any earrings, necklaces.
It's not an earring in your spinach that the salad industry is most worried about. It's E. coli. No one knows exactly how E. coli got onto the tainted spinach in last September's outbreak, but consumers demanded action. California growers quickly came up with voluntary standards for handling and growing leafy greens, like hygiene training for workers and measures to keep animals and their droppings away from farm fields. Consumer groups say the guidelines are too weak, and processors like Fresh Express agree. They have far more restrictive standards of their own. The statewide guidelines call for a 30-foot buffer between leafy greens and grazing cattle. Fresh Express requires 800-foot buffers. Many farmers say they've been pressured to bulldoze or fence off wildlife habitat. Sprinklers water the radishes and peppers on Andy Griffin's organic farm in Hollister, California. Griffin scoffs at the notion you can keep crops safe from pathogens by building fences.
It's ridiculous. You can't fence out the birds. You can't fence out the sky. I mean, I don't know what they're thinking.
Fresh Express wouldn't tell us all the restrictions it puts on suppliers, but Christina Fisher with the Nature Conservancy says Fresh Express has even told farmers it doesn't want to see any frogs in their fields. She says Fresh Express has so much market share, farmers have little choice but to do whatever it says.
I think the farmers are under tremendous pressure. They're being asked to eliminate water quality protections and wildlife habitat that they value as a part of their farming practices in order to maintain their markets for these buyers.
Farmer Andy Griffin says the standards adopted in the name of food safety miss the point.
All of the food goes through a narrow aperture. You know, all of the salads go through just a few salad mix plants. So if there's a contamination of, say, the blade on the cutting machine, you have an opportunity to contaminate salad that's going to feed a whole nation.
Griffin doesn't trust agribusiness to keep food safe, but Bill Clyburn of Fresh Express says his company has never been linked to any foodborne illness. Clyburn says he avoids buying anything but pre-washed salad. He says he doesn't want to eat a head of lettuce that other shoppers have held up to their noses in the produce aisle. In Salinas, California, I'm John Ryan for Marketplace.
Coming up, the fight against music piracy takes a dark turn.
I felt threatened. I felt fearful. I felt like my parental rights had been violated, that they could just come in and say, we're going to bring your daughter in here. It's sick.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bank stocks led the markets lower today. The Dow Industrials dropped 39 points, about 0.3% to end the day at 13,403. The NASDAQ fell about 0.8%, 20 points to close at 2581. The S&P 500 ended the day down 0.5%, 7 points at 1476. Financial stocks fell in part as a run on British mortgage lender Northern Rock continued. About 8% of that bank's deposits have been withdrawn. Merrill Lynch shares fell 2.4%. Citigroup dropped 1.3%. Lehman Brothers slipped 1.5% ahead of its earnings release tomorrow. Everybody's going to be watching that one almost as closely as the Fed meeting. Radio Shack stock fizzled more than 6%. 6.5% lower on reports the company could reduce earnings. Overseas, Britain's FTSE fell around 1.7%. France's CAC 40 fell 1.8%. The German DAX fell 0.25%. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 4.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here are events for Tuesday, September 18th. The Africa Unbound Conference kicks off in Brussels. On the agenda, health and investment strategies for the year 2010. Committees in the House meet to discuss medical care for contractors in Iraq and their families back home. And on this day in history, 1851, the first edition of the New York Daily Times was published. That paper would go on to become the New York Times. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Crude oil closed at better than $80 a barrel today, $80.57 to be exact, up $1.47, a new record. I don't know if she saw that coming or what, but commentator Sandra Tsing Lowe's had about enough of fossil fuels. As she explains in this edition of The Lowdown, she's trying to go solar.
My solar madness began because I live in California and I'm sick to death of Prius's organic food and everyone wailing, "You have to see an inconvenient truth. You just have to." At which point I said, "Okay, I'll bite." Here we are in Los Angeles, the most eco-Nazi city on earth, what with our hectoring celebrities driving their vegetable oil-fueled limos under our 365-day-a-year sun. We should be the leader in solar energy. Even our Hollywood governator has signed a million solar roof initiative. I've got visa in hand. Of course, I am a busy working mother. So I'm wondering, which of you Prius-driving, bleeding polar bear heart Californians can direct me to LA's one-click solar power web shopping? "I've been meaning to make a call," says my friend Amy. "I guess I don't really understand it. There are power credits? Who gets them?" "It's also pretty expensive," warns her husband George. "Even with rebates, our outlay would be at least $10,000. It would take us 8 to 10 years to even recoup." I'm amazed how quickly they've gone from a crunchy granola couple weepily castigating meat eaters to prickly and neurotic yuppie investors running the complex calculations of outlay recouping. So I press on. I find a company called Solar City. The nice representative and I have a fascinating conversation about kilowatt hours, south-facing roofs, satellite images of our house. Really? Fantastic. Now I have all the tools I need to become a total solar pest. I type in the address of my smug Prius-driving friends into Google Earth and send them a cheery email. "Look at all that roof you've got. Very sunny. You're a perfect candidate for solar. Because, hey, if I get a group to buy in bulk, we'll all get 10% off." "We're just feeling strapped," says George. "We just spent $4,000 on this beautiful reclaimed teak bedge, and we don't want our house to look like a factory." "Well, excuse me for trying to bring solar power to the people."
Humorist Sandra Tsing Lowe lives right here in Los Angeles. If the rest of the world lived like you, what do you suppose would happen? Would the earth be cleaner? Would it be dirtier? Greener, do you suppose? Play our new game to find out. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on the link that says Consumer Consequences. At the time, you probably didn't think much of it, if you even noticed it was happening. But 4 years ago this month, the recording industry got serious about illegal file sharing. Since September 2003, big music labels have pressed their case with lawsuits by the thousands. Back then, the industry said it was hoping to scare off an estimated 4 million music-sharing fans. Today, that number has more than doubled to around 9 million people using file trading sites. The industry insists its lawyers are keeping a lid on what it calls song lifting. But in the first of a series of special reports, our senior business correspondent Bob Moon discovered even those targeted by mistake get no reprieve.
Meet Tanya Anderson, an Oregon woman accused by the recording industry of being a flagrant online distributor of illicit music. She's 43 and gets by with the help of Social Security.
I'm supporting my daughter. I'm a single mom and I'm really scared.
Since 2004, she's been caught up in legal limbo with the nation's recording industry. It all began with a letter warning that she had breached undisclosed copyrights and owed hundreds of thousands of dollars. At first, she thought it was a scam until she phoned someone at what the industry calls its settlement support center.
You know, I told him, look, take my computer, look at that. I can prove to you I didn't do this. And he said, what do you guys expect us to look at everyone's computers that says they're innocent?
The first lawyer she consulted offered some advice that turned her stomach.
Just let them take a judgment against you and file bankruptcy. And I told him, why should I have to do that? That's not fair. And he said, I didn't say it was fair. It's how you have to deal with those people.
So it was back on the phone to the settlement center where she says a support rep listened sympathetically.
He ended up telling me, well, you can write a letter to my bosses, but no guarantee once they start a lawsuit, they just don't back off.
And that's when her life went down the rabbit hole.
That's Lori Liebeck, Anderson's lawyer.
Lo and behold, somebody shows up at her door with a federal lawsuit saying, we're going to ruin you, we're going to sue you for over $1 million.
He bases that on the industry's past demands for up to $750 per song. He says Anderson was accused of trading 1,046 music files. Liebeck responded with a counterclaim in the fall of 2005, and Anderson says after that, things really got ugly. It was right around the time she moved to a new home, and her apartment manager got a call.
He told him he couldn't release my personal information. They told him that he would either give it to him or he was going to get in a lot of trouble. It terrified me. Come to find out, they were trying to serve Kylie.
Her daughter, who was just 7 years old when the file sharing supposedly happened. Anderson's lawyer says he was able to confirm that call came from the recording industry's law firm. What remains a mystery is something else that he says happened around the same time.
Calls were made to Kylie's elementary school under the pretext of somebody calling saying they were Kylie's grandmother. And was she there that day? I haven't tracked that call directly back to the law firm, but it was most disturbing, especially since Tanya checked and Grandma made no such calls.
The head of the Recording Industry Association of America refused to comment on any specific case, but Mitch Bainwald did tell us this.
I would remind you that folks, when they have a legal dispute, often can't be creative with the way they portray the facts.
In March of this year, a judge cleared the way for recording industry lawyers to question Kylie Anderson over the protests of her mother.
I felt threatened. I felt fearful. I felt like my parental rights had been violated, that they could just come in and say, we're going to bring your daughter in here. It's sick. You know, I think it's disgusting. And I don't know how those people can sleep at night doing what they're doing. I really don't.
The RIAA insists it uses great care in handling the cases it files. It sent us a statement acknowledging what it terms some isolated incidents. It won't talk about the tactics attorney Lori Liebeck accuses the industry of using in Anderson's case.
It would seem every time she announced her resolve to say, no, you're not going to do this to me, they would ratchet up the abuse a level. Imagine, you have a daughter who was 7 years old at the time, may have listened to Barney, did not use the computer, but they insisted on taking her deposition.
And they were accusing her of downloading such songs as Dope Nose, Bullet in the Head, I Stab People, and Shake That Ass Bitch, and worse.
A lot worse, and you haven't read them on the radio, nor can you.
It seemed to make no sense until he figured out, he says, that the file-sharing account Anderson was accused of using actually belonged to a man almost 200 miles away. Liebeck says it should have been immediately obvious to anyone who bothered to check. He was able to find it out with a simple Google search. And even then, the case dragged on several months more.
It ended when they finally decided that they couldn't keep the charade up any longer. When the federal court forced them to put up or shut up, they quit.
Leaving his client, he says, to deal with tens of thousands of dollars in legal bills. The Electronic Frontier Foundation's Fred Von Lohmann says Anderson is now in the same bind as almost everyone who's challenged the RIAA.
okay, we've won. We want you to pay our legal fees. You dragged us through all of this for nothing. And the recording industry continues to fight tooth and nail. Their attitude is we shouldn't have to pay for your lawyers, even if it turns out you weren't the right person.
Von Lohmann says for the first time, there are signs of some cracks in the RIAA's strategy. In recent days, a judge forced it to pay a Texas woman's $68,000 legal bill.
One of their spokespersons once said, sometimes when you go fishing with a drift net, you catch a few dolphins. And that, I think, really is their attitude about that.
We asked the industry group's chief executive, Mitch Bainwall, if he feels any obligation to set that right.
We feel a responsibility to exercise this program in the most reasonable fashion we possibly can. And I will leave it there. We are very careful. And if somebody has a compelling case that suggests that they might be a dolphin, then we'll look at it.
As for the organization's claim that these cases are isolated, on the opposite side of the country, New York City Attorney Ray Beckerman runs a website tracking the cases of many defendants who claim their innocence, including one of his own.
I have a client with multiple sclerosis, gets around with an electric wheelchair, has no real understanding of what this is about, had nothing to do with any file sharing, knows nothing about it, and they will not drop the case against her.
A doctor was appointed as that woman's guardian and certified she's unable to make decisions in her case. RIAA lawyers remain skeptical, though, and they're pressing the judge to proceed. Beckerman says their tactics speak for themselves.
They have absolutely no heart whatsoever, and I don't know how they live with themselves.
Tanya Anderson says it could happen to anyone.
This is just really wrong that they can get away with doing this, just walk into somebody's life and put them through this. It's not right. They'll continue doing this as long as people don't fight.
Anderson is now seeking class action status for her lawsuit against the big recording labels. She's accusing them of fraud, malicious prosecution, libel and slander, invasion of privacy, deceptive business practices, misuse of copyright laws, and colluding to engage in widespread extortion and racketeering. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we'll explain the music industry's reasoning for its lawsuit campaign and why critics accuse it of using tone-deaf tactics.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we wrap things up today, AOL is packing its bags for New York City. At the moment, the company makes its home in suburban Washington, D.C., out by Dulles Airport. But in the spring, it's moving closer to the bright lights of Madison Avenue, or at least the bright prospects of better ad sales. Parent company Time Warner posted worse-than-expected growth on AOL's advertising sales last quarter. About a year ago, AOL was restructured to get more of its revenue from ad sales instead of ever-slipping subscription fees. AOL's got about 11 million paying customers. That's down from a peak of about 26 million just 5 years ago. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 39 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ dropped 20 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 fell 7 points. That's about 0.5% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, forcing illegal downloaders to pay the piper.
I often run into musicians and artists who say, thank you for what you're doing. We know you take hits for this, but it's about my future. It's about my dream. And I know that our property has to be respected.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.